Welcome to Me Time, the podcast for women in midlife who've been taking care of everyone else and now say, it's my turn to take care of me. I'm Kim Aceto, health and self-care coach for women in midlife and your host. Thank you for spending your precious me time with me right now. Enjoy the show. Okay, so today I'm here with Walker Thornton. I've asked Walker to come back. Let me share a little bit about Walker again for you. So Walker is a public speaker, teacher, and author of Inviting Desire, a guide for women who want to enhance their sex life. She's a strong advocate for women's sexuality, embracing an aging, unapologetically approach to life. Walker, welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, thank you. I'm tickled to be here.
Oh, I love having you on, and I can't wait till I can maybe see you in person again, whenever, who knows when that will be. The last time was you had a conference in LA, and I think I picked you up from your hotel and we went and had lunch and
conversed. Yeah, I think that was right.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. And I'm really glad that we had a time to have that together. So that was a couple of years ago. And what I want to talk with you about today is what happened to you last year. Now, of course, COVID happened to all of us, but something else happened to you last year. And you have so many insights and lessons that you drew from that that I want you to share with the listeners. So that's why I want you to come on and talk about this. So let's get into it. Tell us what happened to you last year.
It's funny when someone says something about last year and I go, it was a challenging year for me. And they all look at me like, well, it was a challenging year for all of us.
Right.
But, you know, I had been going to the gym. I was using, seeing a personal trainer in February, and in March that all came to an end. But I was walking and I was reading, listening to the book, Middlemarch, which is 35 hours on audio. And I began to realize that I was feeling more out of breath than I thought I ought to have been while I was walking. And I have atrial fibrillation, which I get sporadically. I haven't had an episode now in 8 months. So it's not an often thing, but I am aware of my heartbeat. And so in very early May, mid-May, I began to feel that something just didn't feel quite right. I struggled with going to the doctor. And even when I got there, I said to her, I may be overreacting. It was at my cardiologist's office, but I feel like something's not quite right. Very nice, you know, okay, you know, everything looks fine. Your EKG is good, but we'll do a stress test. So a couple of days later, I went in for a stress test, which I failed miserably in that my heart rate and my blood pressure just soared. I made it through, but it raised some concern. And the doctor called me herself and said, I want you to have a cardio ultrasound, something like that.
Hey, Walker, can you share what a stress test is?
Oh, sure. So the stress test that I did is it's designed to see how well your heart functions under a stressful condition. So because I have a fair bit of mobility, I did one on a treadmill. There is one called a nuclear stress test where they can actually inject a medication that mimics activity and they monitor your heart. So I'm standing on this treadmill with a paper half robe thing that just covers my breast, taped together with electrodes all over my body, pants on. There's a male nurse to my left watching a screen, and to my right is a male echocardiogram technician, and I'm gonna stop, lie down on that bed, quickly roll over facing him, and he's going to take pictures and images of my heart. And so they put you on this machine on the treadmill and gradually increase the speed. And there's an elevation to it as well. So I wasn't actually running, but close to it. And I can also watch at the same time, if I look over to the left, I can see how my heart is going because they're doing an EKG monitor at the time. And then they then analyze all of that much later on. So I did that. And of course, my blood pressure got over 200 and something. And the heart rate was at 160 something and a little concerning. So they sent me in for a test, and I apologize, I should have remembered what this was. It's a test where they not only inserted dye, but they gave me nitroglycerin. So, you know, I'm on a table, I've been drinking fluids constantly, even up to the point of the test. I'm masked. There are people in the room behind me who can watch without being exposed to the radiation and the stuff that I'm going to be exposed to, including a doctor, a cardiologist. And they put me through the MRI machine and watched, and then they pulled me out and gave me a nitroglycerin pill. They lifted up my mask and stuck it under my tongue. And it opens the blood vessels even more while they look at all of the vessels and the blood flowing in and out of my heart. And a couple of days later, my cardiologist calls me herself, which is a little unusual. And she says to me, "You have severe coronary artery disease." And she said, "I don't want you to do anything." And I said, "What do you mean?" She goes, "Well, you could go walk to get your mail. You could walk to the car, but I want you just to be real still until we can get you to the hospital." I hung up and I cried. And then it was a Friday, and I had a bit of a panic attack on Sunday. And she'd also said to me on the phone, "I've called the doctor on call for the weekend. I've told him all about your case so that he'll know what to do if you come to the hospital." So on Sunday night, in this sort of panicky place, I went to the hospital to the ER, and they wouldn't let me go. So they put me in the hospital, and I was in the hospital for a little over 10 days. They tried to do angioplasty, you know, where they go in at the wrist. It's really painful, even though you're kind of out of it, to run a line up to the heart. They were going to try and put in stents. But as it turned out, I had three arteries that were 70, 70, and 80% blocked. And my arteries are unusually narrow, so they couldn't do the stents. And when they got me back to the room, they said to me, "We're going to wake you up a little bit more, and then we're going to put you in an ambulance and send you to the bigger teaching hospital here in town, where you will wait for a coronary bypass." So this was the end of May. I could not see my children. I couldn't see anybody. And I was kind of scared. I mean, I realized much later that, I could have had a heart attack. I mean, I could have died. I think it was rough. So they put me in there in a cardiac observation ward, and it took them a day and a half to do all the necessary tests that they needed to do. One of the tests being looking at my leg and my chest in an echocardiogram to find arteries that they can pull out to graft for my heart. My son could have been there for recovery, except that he's in the military and they wouldn't let him leave. He was on lockdown where he was and unable to come. And I remember talking to both of them the night before the surgery, and I was petrified. You know, there were moments when I thought I may die. I may never see my children again. And the surgery was fine. One of the last things I said to the surgeon before he went in, I said to him, I'm still pretty happy about my cleavage here. And I like showing my cleavage. So can you be really careful when you put that cut in me? He just smiled at me. And then I have my younger son on the phone, who's out in Idaho, saying to me, "You know, they're just going to whack your chest open, right, and crack your ribs." I'm like, "Yeah, sweetie, I got that, but let's not go there." And as it turned out, it was fine. It was a, I did well. I recovered more quickly than they had anticipated. So 4.5 days after the surgery, I was home alone. Yeah. I mean, I went in pretty good shape. You know, people kept looking at me and going, "You're having surgery?" Like, yeah, I'm pretty jammed up here. And so it was sort of a dream nightmare like experience, you know, walking around the halls with my monitor and, you know, waiting for the surgery, feeling okay, yet knowing they were going to open my chest, stop my heart, run my blood through this box. It'll have its own doctor completely attending just my blood. But knowing how massive it would be, but not really fully understanding, you know, what that was going to be like. I mean, they give you a book, they send an educator in to talk to you about it all. They go through every piece of it. I asked not to really go through what was going to happen in the process because I kind of had an idea. I did have a neighbor who came and picked me up. We had made an agreement. Her husband had a triple coronary bypass, and she brought me home and spent the first night with me. And the next morning, because I'm one of these women who has a hard time asking for help and is used to going it on my own, she's sitting there reading her book, and I thought, well, she's wasting her time. So I sent her home. She had a key. She lives just three doors down, close doors. We live in a townhouse. And I said, you know, come back in the morning. The door's unlocked. And so I did it mostly alone. 2 weeks later, my son got permission to leave where he lives and travel. And he spent a weekend with me. The neighbor would come back to help me walk some because I had to use a walker for a while. And they wanted me up and out and walking every day, but not if it was too warm, not if it was too humid. And I had a physical therapist come to the house and a nurse. And it was May the 29th, and I made it, you know, and then I'm doing well. But that's sort of the nutshell of what happened to me.
Right. Well, wow. What a thing to go through on top of COVID and, you know, having to do this alone and, you know, already being a person who doesn't like to ask for help and having to ask for help, right? Yeah. What are maybe some of the lessons or insights that you have gained from this experience?
You know, one of the interesting things, I consider myself a strong advocate, a medical advocate, having done caregiving for my ex-husband and then my own mother. But I knew I had high cholesterol. I knew I had high blood pressure. There'd even been a report back that had said she has some stenosis, some blockage in the arteries. But neither of my doctors, my internist or my cardiologist, nor I paid enough attention to that. I could have been doing more. I could have exercised a little bit more. I could have been more careful about my diet. I mean, I just didn't. I also learned on the positive side that I am very strong and very resilient. And you know, it's reassuring to know that you can face something pretty tough and come out of the other side doing well. And I, you know, I've had to relearn my whole body in a way, because even though I just went to the gym today, I go to the gym 3 or 4 days a week. I'm working with a personal trainer again. I lost 30 pounds last year. Well, I got sick two more times. I began bleeding internally and they couldn't quite figure out what it was. I think the conclusion was that I was on too much blood thinner. That hospitalized me twice. Then all my electrolytes dropped and that sent me back to the ER. So through all of that, I've lost a lot of weight. But I've also had to relearn my body. I mean, there's a lot that feels to me like it's changed. The doctor didn't necessarily feel that way, but I do. I feel, I hear and feel my heart rate very often. I've had to sort of relearn, my balance is awful. I don't know what that's really all about. So I'm having to do some work on balance and core strength. And I feel different in a way I can't fully explain. You know, things change. And I think medications are still changing, and we're still sort of looking at what feels different for me. And the wisdom is that it can take a full year to get back to normal. I'm now a little over 7 months. But I feel sure, you know, having lived for however long with only 20 to 30% blood flow into my heart, I mean, I have to be different. I mean, how can it not? And, you know, I can't say I'm any better at letting people help me. Although I did.
I was hoping to hear that one, but.
Well, an ex-boyfriend wrote me, a couple of them did. And that was kind of funny. That's another whole story. To say, you know, I'm so sorry, what can I do? And I texted back and I said, well, you could swing by and buy me lunch and bring it to me. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, good for me. So he did, you know, he walked to the steps at the sidewalk where he parked his car, and I walked out of my door, and he set the food there and I picked it up. And, you know, I was very nervous and cautious and careful in June and July. I couldn't move very fast. I looked pretty weak, and but I also didn't want to get sick again. I was like, oh my God, I've dealt with breathing challenges, and I have vague nightmarish memories of coming out of the recovery. Apparently I didn't do too well coming out of anesthesia as they were trying to take this tube out. And while I don't remember it, I sort of do. And the last thing I want is to be intubated again. So, you know, I was very nervous. But I have learned to how to pace myself, how to do what I need to do. And I'm now much more in tune with what my body needs, say from an exercise point of view, mm-hmm. and a nutritional point of view as well.
Right. Well, let me ask you. So, did the doctor mention anything about like stress, not physical stress, but, you know, all the stress that we're under emotionally or mentally, or when your blood pressure rises and things like that? Not when you're exerting yourself physically, but, you know, kind of, you know, mentally, emotionally, is that an issue as well that can contribute to this?
I think it could. My mm-hmm. surgeon certainly didn't. A male and a surgeon. And, you know, I think his job, because I've seen him once since then, I think he's sort of like, well, you know, we fix the mechanics and there you go. I've seen the cardiologist a couple of times, and she has not really dwelled on that either. But where I did get help and information on that was going to cardiac rehab. And I went for 36 sessions. That's what's covered by Medicare, and hallelujah for Medicare when you're going to have open heart surgery. And I spent an hour there three times a week, hooked up to monitors. All the staff are nurses. You're constantly monitored. They're watching your heart rate, your heart rhythm, everything. And they have me on a variety of machines, you know, tracking progress and checking if everything is okay in each minute of that time. And they did some just one-on-one instructional things. And so there we had conversation about managing stress and coping. And there's a whole lot of letting go in being that sick, you know, that
right.
that much recovery. There's, and in the subsequent problem solvings of why did I bleed? What's happening here? Because by the time I got to the hospital in August, when we were meant to do this last time, I needed two transfusions of blood, two infusions of iron. It had, everything had dipped so low, I was precariously in danger at that point. And I spent 5 nights in the hospital. And there is a, and I've learned that I have to kind of let go to some of some things. Pushing hard to advocate and ask questions, which is always fascinating, because doctors aren't used to patients who have some knowledge and are pretty savvy and vocal about themselves. But one of my biggest lessons this in 2020 was, you know, I can control certain things and certain things I can't. And I just have to sit back and allow things to unfold in their own time.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really get that from medical professionals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned that, you know, you've had, you know, when you were describing your doctors, you intentionally shared that they were male and the surgeon was male and all of that. Was there a reason for emphasizing
that? I sometimes, you know, and I've been to the ER a couple of times, I actually went New Year's Eve. I find as a general rule that my female doctors are more likely to listen and trust. Of course, they're also younger too. They're, you know, they're in their 40s as opposed to their 60s or 70s. I was prepared almost defensively to be in that category of women I hear about sometimes who have heart issues and are not taken as seriously by their doctors as they need to be. And so I was uncertain as to how that would go. And I do think that having female doctors who trust me, and of course I've now proven that I do know what's going on with my body, because I caught all of these things happening, that I get that when I go in and say, so something's really not right, they believe me. And that's been helpful. And I also think that a surgeon in particular comes from a different mindset than a general doctor, even a specialist as a cardiologist. That surgeon is really only focused on, for the most part, the mechanics of what he's got, he or she, or they have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're less likely to spend some time talking about life ever after and other things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, they sort of pass you off to your cardiologist. You know?
Right, right. Now, last time I talked with you, you were 66. Have you had a birthday since?
No, I must have talked to it right. I am 66. I was 66 in August.
Okay. Great. So you're 66 and you are not partnered, right?
Correct. I am not partnered. Yep.
And you were not when you went through this. No. Physical support, it sounds like you had plenty of. People were poking and prodding and cutting open your body and all this, you know, therapy and all this support you had afterwards. Right. But what about emotional support? Do you feel like you had enough of that? Where did you get that from? Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, my sons, one is the military, one is not very talkative or emotive. The other one is. And so their attitude has shifted. I could feel that change in them, that desire to make sure I'm okay and to reassure, but neither one of them is the particularly pour your heart out kind of thing. And in coping with their emotions, and it was clear, especially the younger one who doesn't live near me, it's clear that he was struggling with his own emotions around it as we were heading up to the surgery. I have a couple of friends who I can talk to who I feel that are here, but my closest friend who has sort of been my, almost my COVID partner. She's widowed and we've worked together. So we see each other because she's as careful about masking as I am. So I actually see her at times, but she's not an emotional person. She's willing to listen, but she's that's not her style. And I have a couple of friends I've been able to talk to. But I think I've done a lot of my emotional support work via my journaling. and I'm very talkative. I'm very, you know, I'm out there, I'm all over the place sometimes, but I'm not as good about seeking emotional support as I might ought to be at times. And it's very hard for me, I think, still at this age, even with something as serious and as worth needing support for, shall we say, it's still a little hard for me to go out and kind of ask for it. You know, I had a niece write me and say, I want to send you a meal. You tell me where you want the meal. I will call the restaurant and I will get that food to you. She lives someplace else. And I said, yes, I let her do that. But it was touching. And it was, in a way, it was really hard for me to let her do that for me. And, you know, that's a place I need to work on. Being able to let myself really open up and say, yes, I absolutely need help. Thank you. And that, you know, and I'm not sure that I'll get much better if I didn't really ace that last year when I had such good cause. It's a place to work for. And so I end up taking care of myself. And in my most terrifying moments, I did my daughter-in-law, my one daughter-in-law. I have two, one of them, they're very different. The daughter-in-law out in Idaho, she's a good emotional support for me. She's a very pragmatic woman, but highly intuitive. And she really filled that role for me in some ways.
Mm, that's great to hear. I think all women listening, all of us, we can relate to having a hard time seeking out that emotional support. We're often, you know, expected to be there for others, you know, physically, emotionally, and all other ways. But, you know, we definitely have a hard time doing that ourselves. And so, you know, thanks for being so honest about that. And, you know, it gives us a call to action for all of us to step that part up. Yeah. You know, so thank you for sharing that. Yeah. Last but not least, what's next for you? Now your body has, your body is different, right? Your body has changed. You have changed as a result of going through this. So what are you excited about for your future and what maybe, you know, your body now can do for you in the future, or how you can kind of take care of your body, anything like that? What are you looking forward to?
Well, I made the decision to stop much of my work, so to stop doing public speaking and looking for webinars and teaching and things like that. And so I'm looking forward to continuing to allow myself to say, this is not what I want to do anymore. And that it's okay not to have some big thing that I think defines me. I'm still writing. I'm still working on this memoir that's gotten sidetracked at the moment for months. But I'm looking forward to being able to say, I'm just who I am. I don't have to say, oh, I do this, with that big this being, here's who I am. So I'm looking forward just to sort of, I don't know, seeing what comes next. I'm going to drive across the country to see my son and his family in Idaho early summer. So that's a 4-day at least road trip for me. I am excited about the fact that for the first time, I'm actively enjoying going to the gym.
Wow. Well, that's great. Great to hear. Yeah.
I think it was the cardiac rehab. So it assured me that I wasn't going to have a heart attack because they're giving me feedback. And being 30 pounds lighter, which I definitely needed to do, and having cut back on alcohol hugely, just lost the taste for it. I want to get in shape. When you lose that much weight and you're 66, it actually means that skin's not bouncing back. So I have some kind of funky looking folds and flabs and wrinkles, which I'm working on embracing, but I'm looking forward to getting much more fit. So getting, I'm actually excited that I did 30 minutes on the elliptical today and went back and forward, and I'm I'm excited about sort of embracing my body and giving it more attention, really paying attention to what it is I want. So that notion of, well, what would I like to do right now? So what is it I want to do? And that's where I came to the, I don't really want to push for public speaking anymore. I don't want to market. I don't want to think that I have to find my own self-worth in giving myself a title. And then I'm okay with saying I'm done. So I'm letting go and I'm taking on at the same time. And I'm not feeling any restrictions in my body. I have people tell me I ought to be. I have people tell me I should be depressed. I have people jumping in every now and then to offer up something, but my body feels great. And I want to kind of take advantage of that so that I can go do something, I'd say athletic. I could go and walk a new city and feel comfortable doing that. And I've also learned just to sit still too. And I've learned that I'm quite okay sitting here. I've also gotten, I could give you another whole hour conversation on how I've learned to let go of the whole, I need to have a man in my life. That's come up for me too.
Well, that sounds like another episode.
Well, but you know, I'm in a really good place, far better than I could ever have imagined. And the amount of gratitude I have to my heart, and I tell my heart that every single night at bedtime. And I feel like there are two of us here. I thought about this morning. My heart is like this another entity here. And we are interacting and engaging, and I'm ever grateful. And it's opening up for me, and I'm facilitating and benefiting from that.
Literally and figuratively.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, yeah. Walker, hey, thank you so much for sharing your experience and, you know, reliving that with us, that very scary experience, but all the lessons and insights and wisdom that you gained from this experience. Wow. Sometimes it takes something like that, right? To learn some of those lessons. But I'm really excited to hear and see, you know, what happens next, you know, and what you get into and what your body's going to allow you to do. And so it was really wonderful to have you on. Thank you so much for sharing your story. Okay. And then can people still find you at walkerthornton.com?
Yes. Okay. And I am going to write about this some. I haven't written about it much, but I also, I'm on Instagram. I think it's WJT62. And then it has my name in it. And I took a picture of myself. So there is a picture of me with my hands covering my breast of my whole scar. I did this a couple of months ago. So if you want to see what that scar looks like, and the bold me with the body and the three little dots underneath of the scar, which are where there were three chest drainage tubes. It's kind of a funny looking thing. So I'm speaking some about my progress and my recovery there as well.
Well, that's
thank
great.
You. Yeah.
You got it. And I'll put your link in the show notes and your handle. There you go. Your Instagram handle. Yeah. We'll put that there as well. All right, Walker, take care. Thanks again.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
If you find the Me Time Midlife podcast valuable, there are many ways you can support it. The best way is to simply tell your midlife friends about it. It also helps the show's visibility if you rate and review it on iTunes, Stitcher, or simply directly in your Apple Podcasts app if you listen to the show that way. And if you want more me time in your life and continue the conversations we have on the show with other women on a similar journey, consider joining our Me Time Midlife community on Facebook. Simply search for Me Time Midlife Community in your Facebook search bar or go to metimemidlifepodcast.com to learn more. Thank you again for listening. And until next time, remember, you've been taking care of everyone else. It's your turn to take care of you.